Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Max Garcia of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, who reports on the historic victory of the leftist Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front in El Salvador's March 15th presidential election. Vincent Warren of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses his concerns about the direction the Obama administration is taking in making a clean break with Bush-era human rights abuses. And former Israeli soldier turned peace activist Yaniv Reshef, who tells a story of unexpected human contact encountered during his service in the occupied Palestinian West Bank. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While giant financial service companies like Citibank and AIG remain at the center of the global economic crisis, in recent years, these same financial institutions have nurtured relationships with corrupt regimes. According to the British human rights group Global Witness, big banks such as Citibank, Barclays, and HSBC exploited loopholes in anti-corruption laws to service wealthy oil clients in corrupt states like Equatorial Guinea, Charles Taylor's Liberia, and Turkmenistan in Central Asia. Global Witness is calling on the G20 nations, who represent 80% of the global economy, to strengthen bank transparency rules and force banks to identify the real customers in international transactions. In 2004, Riggs Bank collapsed after a U.S. Senate investigation exposed its ties to oil funds held by the corrupt regime in Equatorial Guinea. Through various accounts, Citibank allowed former Liberian President Charles Taylor, now on trial for war crimes in The Hague, to personally use the global banking system to profit from timber sales. Global Witness points out that these same big banks are members of the elite Wolfsburg Group, which advocates voluntary anti-corruption standards. Their report reveals that these voluntary guidelines had no effect on corrupt banking practices. On the 50th anniversary of his exile from Tibet, the Dalai Lama condemned the Chinese crackdown on last spring's protests, calling conditions in his country hell on earth. Fearing another wave of protests, China imposed a massive crackdown on Tibet and nearby provinces in the days leading up to the March 10th anniversary. According to the Los Angeles Times, roads leading to remote Tibetan villages were filled with armed personnel carriers and buses filled with riot police. Security cameras were also visible in the capital city of Lhasa, where ethnic Chinese merchants were attacked by Tibetan protesters last March. The Dalai Lama held three sets of talks last year with Chinese authorities seeking more autonomy for Tibet, but the talks ended in failure. Meanwhile, younger Tibetan activists are advocating independence for Tibet. Columbia University Tibet expert Robbie Barnett told the Christian Science Monitor, "Things are more critical than they have been in many, many years. This is a tinderbox, and the Chinese are very aware of that." Connecticut Congressman John Larson has proposed a bill to create a broad-based carbon tax to fight global warming. So far, the Larson bill has little support, as the Obama administration and congressional Democrats have embraced the market-based cap-and-trade system to control carbon emissions. Even Nobel Prize winner Al Gore has withdrawn his support for a carbon tax and now backs the administration's push for a cap-and-trade system. In an email to the New York Times, Gore said that the cap-and-trade model offered a realistic prospect for a global treaty on climate change and argued that the politics of passing a carbon tax were just too difficult. Gore and many top Democrats were burned during President Clinton's first term when their proposed BTU tax was harshly attacked by Republicans. Democrats are also wary because the Liberal Party in Canada pushed an energy tax in last fall's election and went on to lose seats to the ruling Conservative Party of Stephen Harper. Larson's bill would impose a $15 tax per metric ton of carbon from mines and refineries. Revenue from the tax would provide a payroll tax rebate as well as investments in clean energy. Larson and many economists say the carbon tax is the most direct way to mitigate carbon emissions, as the tax does not rely on complicated carbon credit derivatives. Carbon tax backers also note that the European cap-and-trade system has failed to meet its own emission reduction targets. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After a bloody civil war that killed over 75,000 people and spending 20 years in political opposition, El Salvador's leftist Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, or FMLN, won a historic presidential election victory on March 15th. Voters in the Central American nation cast ballots for FMLN presidential candidate Mauricio Funes, a well-known television journalist, defeating his opponent, Rodrigo Ávila, of the right-wing Nationalist Republic Alliance, or ARENA, by a slim 2-point margin. The ARENA party was founded by notorious death squad leader Roberto d'Aubuisson during El Salvador's civil war. Among d'Aubuisson's thousands of victims were Catholic priests, nuns, lay workers, and San Salvador Archbishop Oscar Romero, who had advocated for El Salvador's poor. The Reagan and first Bush administration provided military, economic, and political support to successive conservative governments in El Salvador fighting the FMLN guerrillas. After a peace agreement was signed between the government and rebels in 1992, the FMLN formed a political party where they won legislative seats and controlled municipal governments. Before the March 15th election, several U.S. Republican congressmen had attacked the FMLN, accusing them of being allies of Iran and al-Qaeda, and threatened to halt $40 billion in remittances sent back home from Salvadorans living in the U.S. After winning national power for the first time, the FMLN now faces a global economic crisis, extreme disparity between the rich and poor, and high crime and murder rates. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Max Garcia, coordinator of the New York chapter of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, or CSPACE, a U.S.-based group founded during the Civil War. Reached in San Salvador after observing the election, Garcia reports on the historic nature of the FMLN victory and the challenges ahead for President-elect Mauricio Funes and his running mate, Salvador Sanchez Serén.
This election marked a real shift in what is possible in this country. I think that we were expecting a much higher voter turnout. We were expecting about 67%. We got about 61% of voter turnout. But as low as that is, I think that a lot of people who might not have voted in this election because they expected so much fraud to occur will lose a lot of that cynicism. And spaces for organizing, spaces for mobilizing will be opened up, and the social movement that put this victory together for the people of El Salvador are really going to be in a place that, again, can only be described as unique on the scene of Latin American politics.
Tell our listeners a little bit about the new president of El Salvador, Mauricio Funes. He's a TV personality known to many Salvadorans, but many of us don't know a lot more about him. Tell us.
Mauricio Funes is a former TV journalist. He was a very popular journalist for his uncompromising style. He was very direct in criticizing both the left and the right for mistakes made in the past. This brought him a lot of credibility, along with a lot of death threats. It's a reality that he was able to not only deal with, but to be brought into the FMLN, the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front Party. He was brought in as a person who wasn't a member of the organization, but that the political organization approached him to represent them as their presidential candidate on this ticket. This is something that he accepted with a lot of pride. This is something that he accepted because he knew that it would give him a platform to really take this country in a direction that it has not seen ever in its history.
The vice presidential candidate for the FMLN was a former guerrilla comandante. Tell us a little bit about him.
Salvador Sanchez Serén, that vice president-elect, was a former commander in the guerrilla when the FMLN transitioned into a political party, and he was a signatory to the peace accords of 1992 that ended the 12-year civil war that brought about 80,000 deaths and death squads and really demonstrated the abyss that the right-wing part of this country could take the country into.
Well, Max, I wanted to ask you, what is the program of the FMLN, the Farabundo Martín National Liberation Front? Now that they've won the election, what can Salvadorans expect from them?
Because of the constitution of El Salvador, the executive branch in this country is very, very powerful. You have absolute power when naming members onto the Supreme Electoral Tribunal, which is, again, the governing body that sanctions and certifies elections in this country, and that is responsible single-handedly for how an electoral process is run. Not only that, but the electoral code in this country doesn't allow for things like campaign contribution oversight. You can have different organizations, different dummy organizations set up, have bank accounts created, have tons of money funneled into them, and have slander attacks and have those groups be responsible for dirty campaigning, but then one can't investigate into who's funding those groups. So that's one of their main things, is to make the democratic process in this country that much more transparent. Moreover, they believe that with the Obama administration, the way that this new administration and its embassy has just in the last 24 hours reached out to them and said that they will work with them and that they look forward to having peaceful relationships with them. Those spaces for creating that change in this country, pushing this country towards a popularly, democratically mandated country, public education, public health care, mass movements that reject mining, mass movements that reject the devastation of its ecosystems, mass movements that want to have sovereignty, that do not approve of free trade agreements. These are the kinds of things that this government feels it has a popular mandate to do.
That was Max Garcia, coordinator of the New York chapter of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. Contact the group by calling area code 202-521-2510 or visit their website at cispes.org. On March 13th, the Obama administration announced that it would abandon the Bush administration's term enemy combatant, while at the same time arguing in court for the continued detention of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The Obama Justice Department stated that the legal rationale for holding some 240 prisoners at Guantanamo will now be based on laws passed by Congress and, by extension, international law, including the Geneva Conventions. Within days of being sworn into office, Mr. Obama pledged to close the Guantanamo prison within a year. The Justice Department said that only those detainees who provided substantial support to Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or similar groups, or who were part of those groups, would be considered candidates for detention. But troubling to many human rights groups was the vague definition of what constitutes substantial support for a militant group and the more than 600 prisoners now being held at the Bagram U.S. Air Base in Afghanistan. Also of concern to civil liberties advocates was the Obama administration's decision to shield top Bush administration officials from lawsuits brought by prisoners who say they were tortured while being held at the Guantanamo Bay prison camp. As Congress and the administration are considering their options to hold Bush administration officials accountable for violations of U.S. and international law, either through the appointment of a special prosecutor or the establishment of an independent truth commission, disturbing information has come to light that could increase the urgency of such an undertaking. Renowned investigative reporter Seymour Hersh told an audience at a University of Minnesota event about his unpublished reporting on an ongoing covert military operation that he described as an executive assassination ring, conducted out of former Vice President Cheney's office and illegal domestic spying conducted by the CIA. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Vincent Warren, executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses his concerns about the direction the Obama administration is taking in making a clean break with Bush-era human rights abuses.
We all thought, based upon what Barack Obama was saying on the election trail, that he was going to take much more of a definitive and clean break from Bush administration policies. And while it's true that he focused on closing the base known as Guantanamo and issued an executive order on his second day in office, I believe, saying that the facility was going to be closed in a year. There are other things that he has done or hasn't done that have actually been extremely troubling, quite honestly, when you look at what he could have been doing. And so in his executive orders, he's done things like order the base closed, order a review of whether Guantanamo complies with the Third Convention of Geneva, closing the secret CIA black sites, and dealing with the rendition issue. And then the other categories are positions that the Obama administration could have taken that would have been a marked departure from the Bush administration. And we see that actually when it gets into court and when you put your money where your mouth is, he hasn't been moving very far away from the Bush administration position on a range of issues that are important to us. So, for example, you know, one of the things that Barack Obama did was he said, "I want to order a review of the Guantanamo camp to find out if it complies with the Geneva Conventions." And Admiral Walsh, I believe his name was, a couple of weeks ago, issued a report that said, "Hey, guess what? Clean bill of health. Guantanamo complies with Geneva III." However, you know, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and just so your listeners know, we filed the first habeas corpus petition back in 2002 and have been fighting that battle and the issues of rendition and warrantless wiretapping ever since. We have lawyers that are down there all the time, and our analysis in the two-month period of January and February was that, in fact, the base was as bad as it ever was, certainly as bad as it was when George Bush was the president. This is what we found, but yet it was a complete whitewash that was handed to Barack Obama. You know, moving on from that, we found that while Barack Obama did issue an executive order to close the secret CIA black sites, and these are the sites in 8 or 9 different countries, and it's been reported to be in Thailand and Afghanistan and different places. This is where the CIA held people who that they had rendered, people like some of our clients that we have in Guantanamo, that weren't held in Guantanamo, and this is where people were waterboarded. He closed those sites, but what he didn't do in his executive order, he didn't close the door on whether the CIA can actually conduct similar interrogations in the future. He also didn't rule out on extraordinary rendition. This is where people get kidnapped and sent to other countries around the globe. He didn't say that the CIA could not issue rendition, that there was a period of time that he left open that the CIA or other groups can pick people up off the street and hold them. He didn't say what that time was. But we find this to be all illegal, and it is less of a departure from George Bush than we certainly would have wanted. And then when you move to the second category of what Barack Obama has been doing in the context of the litigation, we have two interesting examples. One is with respect to Bagram Air Force Base. And the question is whether the Boumediene decision, that's the Supreme Court decision that we and other lawyers won in June, that found that there was a constitutional right for habeas corpus for men held in Guantanamo. The legal question is, does that right extend to men that are being held by the U.S. government, but in other places, like, for example, Bagram Air Force Base? And the Obama administration had said quite clearly that their view was that Boumediene only holds true for Guantanamo, but would not hold true or people being held in other places under the same circumstances.
As you and many of our listeners are aware, Seymour Hersh, the acclaimed investigative journalist, let loose with a little bit of a bombshell of information regarding his current investigation for a future book that revealed the Bush administration had what he described as an executive assassination ring that would be going from country to country, killing with impunity, with real no reporting to any existing chain of command within the CIA or any other known structure, but was reporting directly to the office of Vice President Dick Cheney. You want to make a comment about that and how you think this information, if it's proven out, may feed into a louder cry for accountability for the Bush administration than we have right now?
I remember when I heard about that, there was a part of me that was shocked, and there was another part of me that was absolutely unsurprised. And I think the full story of the Bush administration and their activities has not come out yet. And I think what it tells us is that the need for accountability for this administration is so incredibly strong. You know, Senator Leahy has proposed a truth commission for these crimes, and the Center for Constitutional Rights opposes it, not because the truth isn't important, because it is. But the Leahy proposal has no accountability mechanism that's tied to it. That's not the way that we need to go. What we need to do is we need to make sure that there is a criminal investigation, that the vice president's office has its own hit squad that will go in and do targeted assassinations is absolutely deeply appalling. And if it's true, it needs to be punished to the fullest extent of the law, because otherwise, Scott, how can we ever be sure that future presidencies will not be tempted to engage in the very same or worse behavior when the next terrorist activity happens?
That was Vincent Warren, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at ccrjustice.org. On March 16th, two members of Combatants for Peace, an Israeli and a Palestinian, spoke at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut, as part of their Northeast speaking tour. The group was founded in 2005 by four former Palestinian resistance fighters and seven Israelis who had served as soldiers in the Israel Defense Force. The group had to overcome great fear and suspicion as they began meeting with each other, but were drawn together by the belief that more violence and revenge killings are not the way to achieve a peaceful, just resolution of the long-running Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Combatants for Peace, which now has 600 members, calls for an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and control of Gaza. The Israeli speaker, Yaniv Reshef, served in an elite military sabotage unit whose members were known as Golani. He now lives in a village near the Israeli town of Sderot, which is often hit by crude missiles fired from Gaza. Reshef acknowledges that the Israeli occupation in which he participated was brutal, but said it pales in comparison with Israel's recent invasion of Gaza, in which more than 1,200 Gazans were killed, including more than 400 children. At the end of his talk, Reshef told the following story about the first Intifada or Palestinian rebellion, which lasted from 1987 to 1993.
We were considered too good soldiers to spend us on this, and so they sent us to Lebanon, but at one occasion during training, they said, well, there's a lot of balagan, that means mess, in Gaza, and we need Golani to come and make some order. So when you're traveling by day, put your brown beret so everybody will know Golani is here and we'll be afraid of you. And indeed, they were afraid of us because we had our reputation. And my unit specially worked at night. And one night, the order was, let them know that we can always find them at any time. At any place, enter their houses, their streets, the place where they are shopping. So we were walking at night, entering this family's house. And Jabalia, if you've ever seen a refugee camp, it's like Bombay. It's like the most populated place on earth. You know, the streets are narrow, and with the water running in the streets, terrible conditions. We entered this family house. We were as in Lebanon. Helmet, anti-bullet helmet, anti-knife vest, then the vest for the magazine, then the M16, the commando knife, some grenades, surely a lot of other things on the back I don't remember. We were soldiers like you see in the movies, but this wasn't a movie and it wasn't Lebanon, it was a house. Like some group of soldiers now enters and surrounds you with guns to your head, this was us. And the family was of five members. They had just a young couple and three children. They lived in two small rooms, like take two bathrooms over here, the size of the apartment. And we put them in one room and began to search when we heard a noise behind the wall. There was something inside the wall. And we were very alert and with guns to the wall when we saw a small door in the wall. So for us it was like bingo, the big prize, like there is the terrorist that we're looking for. In Lebanon, we were a lot of times shooting first and asking later. And I think this is the situation today in the occupied territories, as in Iraq. And not because your soldiers or our soldiers are bad, they're just afraid for their lives. And they are put in there by their leaders. They're not the problem, let's say. They're only suffering from it and making others suffer. So we noticed that there was a door, and we were at the door, aiming at the door, and the father said, "No, no, no, it's okay," and went bravely behind our guns and opened the door. In Gaza, in occupied territories, in general, the rate of unemployment is very high. People trying to raise food and find food in any way they can, and it's common to find inside the houses people that are raising for meat rabbits, huge 8-kilo rabbits like this. Something, it's a big animal, but very nice, it's a rabbit. So this gentleman wanted to break the tension. He just took one of the rabbits and put it in my hands. And then he took another and another and another, and I was like with one hand with the gun, and the other, because I had kind of a shelf, because of the magazines, I was holding the rabbits. And we understood that, well, it is not dangerous for us. And without thinking, just naturally, we began to pet the rabbits. We were like a group of soldiers petting rabbits. And it was, I think I remember this moment because it was very surrealistic moment. Like, you would say it can happen only in a movie. Well, in a movie, this is the moment that the voiceover will say, "And then I understood, I'm wrong." Well, it didn't happen. I was sure I'm doing the right thing. I'm sure I was looking for the terrorist. And now I know for real that I was cheated, I think, by my leaders. In the same way that your soldiers are now occupying Iraq, which has nothing to do with what happened on the Twins. Nothing to do. It was Al-Qaeda, Iraq with Al-Qaeda. It had no connection. But someone used your fears for their interests.
That was Yanni Vershef of Combatants for Peace. For more information, visit the group's website at combatantsforpeace.org or call 650-325-4663 for information on the sponsor of the speaking tour. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.